Accession number 28898, reel 8.
Matt Charles with reel 8.
So, the engineer officer got off to talk to somebody. I don't know what it was, just perhaps just to have a cup of tea or something. So I was pottering around the aircraft. I thought, well, I'll get it. I wonder if it'll start those batteries. Because it would, you know, it could start the batteries. So I got a required amount of pumping on the old petrol pump. And then just set the throttle, press the two starters, and the engine went boom, 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 went live. So I thought, right, I'm off. So I took off, and I was worried as hell that the engine might cut out on takeoff, but it didn't. I flew with the undercart down, all the way down to Speke, and taxiing, and landed at Speke. And as I got out, the aircraft was like a sort of tired old elephant. You can hear it sort of going, as the other legs all collapsed, and the legs it's all sagged. And in fact, it was towed away to the scrapyard. But we, our little headquarters was round the back of the thing at the bottom. So I taxied there. I said, okay, first, get the stuff out. Quickly, get it all out. So I said, right, and left the aircraft there. And I went into our little crew room, which we used to have there. And there were a couple of fellows with their feet up, just reading magazines, not doing very much. I said, well, where is everybody? You know, where's the administration? He said, the unit was closed down a month ago. I said, doesn't MSF belong anymore? And said, no, there's no such thing now. Finished. So I thought, well, that's a great. What do I do now? I mean, is there a CO or anybody here? I said, no, there's nobody here, just us. We're just waiting to go to find some, get some unit, get some posting to go to a unit. So I thought, right, get some of these bottles of sherry in. I got set up a little party. So we had a big party on the sherry that I brought up. And then the aircraft was towed immediately to a scrap place where it had a north of Speke. They had a little American aircraft, British aircraft, that was scrap waiting to be sorted out for anything that was worthwhile. It was just towed into this net there. It was totally unflyable. So that was my last trip with the Merchant Service Fighter Unit.
Can I ask you a little bit about some of the Atlantic convoys that you initially did? Was there an area where you would be on standby particularly?
We were on standby the whole time.
Did you go right across the Atlantic?
Oh yes, from Liverpool to Halifax, Nova Scotia. That was our...
Would there be an area obviously where the Condors wouldn't be able to reach, or would you...
Well, the further you got, of course, across there, they only had a certain amount of range. They could get to the middle of the Atlantic. There were still U-boats gathered along the American coast, and so they're always the Atlantic was packed with U-boats at that time. Our loss of merchant ships was almost we couldn't live with that loss. It was too great. So there were U-boats everywhere. That was always a constant worry with U-boats. There'd always be U-boat alarms going off. And
when you were on standby, would you ever sit in the aircraft?
Yes, if there were alarms. If sometimes, you see, going out there, a Sunderland or a Catalina would fly out. And the Merchant Navy and the Navy have no idea of aircraft recognition. Any aircraft came anywhere near the convoy, they'd all fly at it. So I'd always be the person who'd run up, stand on the bridge and run up the friendly flag. Stop firing, friendly aircraft, and they'd all go, okay, and so stop firing. Until you recognise it, we were up in the cockpit and you're waiting.
And were you launched against a Condor at all?
No, I had no launches against any aircraft. All my launches, I managed to get back to land one way or the other.
Would you launch off as the ship was coming in, as you explained in that last story? Mm. Would you launch off as you came into sort of UK coastal waters? Would you usually fly off to Speke at that point?
Yes, that's the last one I did.
But would you do that each convoy?
No, the first one. was lifted off by a crane, and the one in the Mediterranean that just said, Lord knows what happened to that, I just left it on the aircraft. and got off the ship as quickly as possible because the shells were flying around like that.
And was there a problem with serviceability, do you think? I mean, you mentioned...
Well, there was, yes. A very good hand-picked team of four airmen who were really first-class, who, as I said, one was an airframe man, one was an electrician, one was an engine man, one was an armourer. And they were very, very good, very hard-working. And, you know, you take their advice, so things are okay, because I'm not an engineer. But they were very good. If they said something was wrong, I took their word for it. But very good ground crews. They were first class. My first thought when we beached in Newburn was to get the airmen ashore because everybody was very, very frightened. We'd been bombed all the time and dive bombed, and it was just there's a battle going on there.
With the aircraft on there, would they service the aircraft still sitting on the forecastle?
No, it went ashore, we left it.
No, I was thinking when you actually, when you're actually on, say, the night.
Oh, yes, yes.
Would it always stay on the forecastle?
Yes, they'd go out every day, they'd go out and run around, run the engine for a couple of minutes. Couldn't run the engine too long because of the petrol. But they'd, give it a good look around.
Must have been a very rugged aircraft to stay at the forecastle of a ship in all weathers, really.
Well, it was, yes, it was a hurricane, as I've mentioned, first of all, apart from the fact that it was canvas covered. It was a very strong frame, very, very rugged aeroplane. It could take quite a bit of damage and still fly. It was a strong aeroplane.
And how did you feel as an airman really being at sea for much of that time?
I didn't like it a bit, because the seamen didn't know who the hell we were and treated us like dirt. And the ship's officers were... Well, we didn't talk the same language at all. So we just sort of stuck to our own devices. But, I mean, the seamen, they'd gone through a hell of a lot. I don't think I went on a merchant ship with... Most of the seamen hadn't been in boats, torpedo. They were nervous. In fact, one of the ships, the second mate, went berserk. He was running around the bridge in his underpants. And he had to be locked in his cabin. His nerves just collapsed.
Did you find it a more nervous experience being on a ship where, in many respects, you could do very little, as opposed to when you were in combat with six...
Well, yes, to a certain extent, yes, because you weren't in charge... You weren't in charge of your own safety. When if a torpedo hits you, it hits you, and that's the end of that. Or if you get dive bombed, you can't get out and do anything about it. You can't. Well, it's like we're only dive bombed in the Mediterranean, but we were grounded then by order of the authorities there.
Was that frustrating, knowing that you could have possibly done something against the aircraft that were attacking you?
Well, we couldn't. There were so many of them. You get 10 Marchettis coming in here, you get Stukas coming down here, you get the U-boats in amongst that. It was just we'd have been shot down by our own... Seamen, when they're under attack like that, are so jittery. You see, I actually manned a 202 cannon. Erlikon, 20mm Erlikons, in a battery of two on the wing of the ship. And I had to go at that, sort of firing at these things as they came by. But you see, when a torpedo bomber comes through the convoy, it's low level, and every ship in it, every gun, a merchant ship had quite a few guns on it, and everybody's firing at this point. But of course, half the time you're firing at other ships as it goes through. So funnily, you had a ping, boing, bang, as shells were going through the funnel of the ship or hitting the side of it. So it was just total bedlam. This, particularly when the four of us were trying to make for Bone. I mean, that was they were really out to get us. And to see two of them go up, oh, dear me, that was frightening. Well, in fact, one stage, I said, how do you feel? He said, I feel bloody frightened. I said, so do I. I said, look, let's go down below and play a game of poker. So we went down below, and we brought some bits of paper, £100, £1,000 on the piece of paper. And we were playing for £1 million on the UA. We just to do something. But it was still racket noise going on, but we couldn't stay below too long because we had a... we were terrified of being trapped in a vessel if it went down. I think we were just in some corner of the bridge or something like that. Because we had a jump-off kit with us all the time.
What did you keep in your jump-off kit?
I can't remember. A bit of medical equipment, I think. Some water. Just a little survival pack that you might need if you are something to eat. I think we have some biscuits and dry socks. Just sort of odd bits. I can't really remember now.
And with the unit that you were in, how was that? Was that different from squadron life?
Because totally different. Absolutely different.
How did that work? What was discipline like? What was it like as a unit?
Well, we weren't ever together as a unit. So there's a little group always in Nova Scotia waiting to come back this way. A group in Speke waiting to go perhaps to Murmansk, which was a suicidal trip. And a group waiting to go to Gibraltar, passing each other. And so, you know, I didn't meet some of the people, although they're a small unit, perhaps 20 pilots total, if that. But I never met some of them at all, the whole time I was there. Because they were in Canada whilst I was in Gibraltar, or sort of in Murmansk. But the Murmansk convoy, thank God I didn't get put on one of those, because I think we lost every fellow who went on that one.
And was the security attached to the unit? Because you've said a couple of times that people might not have known what you were doing. Were you briefed on security? And was it a secret thing?
Yes, it was a secret unit. And that's why we were on the manifest of the ship. We were always put down as able seamen, as an able seamen child. In fact, he used to help chipping ice off decks and things. And I was just dressed in seamen's clothes when I was standing down a bit. If they capture the vessel and they see they're going to wonder where the pilots are, so they're going to find out eventually. It seems silly to me, but anyway, that was what we had to do. We were on board on the manifest as able seamen. And no, it's totally different from being in the squadron where you're together all the time. You fly together, you fight together. We're just on our own. Either one pilot or two pilots on a vessel with a four ground crew.
And at Speke, was it just really just the commanding officer and administration?
That was where the administration was down. That was the headquarters of the unit, was at Speke. But, it was very different. I mean, if I'd realised what it was going to be like, I don't think I would have wanted to go on it. It was terrible. At least you could have a shower and a bath when you're fighting quite out of base in England. You had a comfortable bed to sleep in. It's the total discomfort and bad food and the cockroaches. Do you know, on the bridge, the fellow used to bring me up, one of the seamen used to bring me up, all the officers on the bridge, so three officers perhaps on the bridge, the captain and the navigating officer and somebody else, and bring it up, cocoa like that. And you'd drink down to about that far, a bit further, then your lips would touch something. And you'd know there's cockroaches, that much cockroaches at the bottom. It was just awful living conditions, absolutely tacky food, terrible living conditions. I mean, I take my hat off to you. They're the unsung heroes of the war, merchant seamen. They had a terrible time. They were torpedoed and bombed. They weren't given much credit for it. They lived always in a terribly uncomfortable conditions. Always, never knowing when they're going to be torpedoed. And, they're all put on most of the nervous wrecks. they did a magnificent job, they really did.
Equally, you said that the amount of time that you'd spend if you were travelling with the slowest ship in the convoy.
Yeah.
Was there an element of boredom as well for you?
An element of boredom, but always touched with the knowledge that you could be hit by a torpedo. It's out of the blue any time, with no warning, you could be struck by a torpedo.
So there was always this underlying threat, was there?
Oh, absolutely, yes. You couldn't take your clothes off throughout the whole trip.
How would you pass the time?
Talking, playing cards, really, to play cards with each other, some sort of patience or something. I've been to Madagun. If you're on standby, you're on standby, of course. Wondering, keeping some idea of what position you're in, or where I'm at. Would you get corvettes? They're the smallest of ships. Navy people sailing in corvettes, they had a tough time. They rolled like mad, almost over 45 degrees. And see these chaps, those who wear civilian clothes when they're these naval people at sea. And they'd be crammed into the bridge, all huddled together, rolling like mad. And it'd come alongside, and shouts were loud, "Hey there, hey, what's that thing on the front of your vessel?" And say, so "It's bloody hurricane." "Well, crikey, why are you doing this?" They'd never seen one before. And they're all curious, so they just come alongside and talk to us. But, oh, they had a tough time. This corvette used to take a convoy right across to America, not go ashore, then bring a convoy back again. And I don't know how those poor fellows stuck it out, because they rolled like mad. I just think they were going over. They'd pitch and they'd thunder down into the water.
Did you suffer from seasickness or when you started doing it?
No, fortunately I didn't. I used to get a headache for the first two or three days. I suppose it was a form of seasickness. And then I settled down and it didn't worry me. Apart from the bang, you know, the discomfort of being rolled about and banged and water coming out of the side and all that. So it was just a very, very, very uncomfortable way of living on a merchant, particularly when there's no establishment for you, you know, there's nowhere to put you because you're spare, as it were.
And how did you work your standby system? How long would you be on for and your co-pilot on for?
Well, it used to vary. If we thought it was fairly quiet, we'd probably have 4 hours on, 4 hours off. And then when it got dark, we'd just stand down for the night.
Yeah, there would be no question if
you couldn't do it.
No. Can I ask as well, you mentioned that if you had have taken off to attack a condor, that you would bail out. Was there a question you would ever ditch, or was it
told that you would bail out? Ditching in both Hurricane and Spitfire had radiators under the wings. And if you try to ditch, and the Hurricane is under the fuselage, what has happened was that the water would, because you that angle when you're ditching, because you're stalled, water would rush into the radiator and it flips onto its back. So, ditching. Some fellows did try ditching Spitfires, and they used to ditch them sideways, so to see, but they'd almost always go on a straight off the back. Because water would rush into the radiator, you see, and pull it over.
So what kind of height would you be in when you bail out across the convoy?
Well, it depended upon weather conditions. I was looking out for cloud conditions. I mean, some fellows had to bail out through cloud, put themselves a mile ahead, circle the destroyer first, and to go waggle the wings, climb up through the cloud, go a mile ahead, and bail out, and go through the cloud and come down. But you wouldn't bail out under 2,000 feet. But it wouldn't.
And was that obviously the problem you mentioned, the pilots who went on the Arctic convoys, of course?
They were just shot out of the sky. They were attacked all the way up and down. Only about a third of convoys got through to Murmansk. A third of each convoy would make it. The rest would be torpedoed and blown out of the water. And pilots had nowhere to go apart from Russia. One or two made it to Murmansk airfield, but the Russians took them prisoner and said, "What the hell are you doing here?" They let them go after a long interrogation.
So what happened to you at the end of your period with the unit then?
When it had gone, I got a posting eventually to Lem Group, Maidstone, Westmoreland near Maidstone. Went to Red for a week or two to get re-established on Spitfires again.
What Spitfire was it by that stage?
Spitfire. That's where I met Burling, as I told you about him. He was the gunnery sort of trainer there. Fantastic work. And then fortnight there, just to get used to flying Spitfires again, and straight back into the battle.
Can you tell me a little bit about Burling? Because I think we talked about it off the tape.
Burling?
What he was like as a man.
Oh, well, he, he was virtually unapproachable. I mean, he was a lumberjack from northern Canada, and he didn't have any friends. He grunted, he didn't talk. In some Canadian accent, you can hardly understand. And he was just a natural born marksman in the air. And he had no idea of fear. He had just feared into, you know, other chaps got frightened. He never got frightened of anything. He was a complete one off.
Did he practice a lot?
Well, he flew all he could, yeah, he flew all the time he could. See, at Rednal, where I did my refresher course on Spitfires, where he was the gunnery officer, he'd take you up in master, and he'd sit in the back seat where the hood came up. He'd look through, and so, what do they call it, the gun sight, where you have a ball and a ring ahead, not the reflector sight you had in the Spitfire, but the ring and bead sight, that's right, set at an angle. And with one machine gun in the wing, which always slewed the aircraft, when I fired it, he could put 100% of his bullets into a drogue every time. We said, well, how did he do it? It's really got to allow it for the slew, and he couldn't explain how he did it. That's a problem. He was a very good gunnery chap, but he couldn't express himself.
What about his personal behaviour?
His personal behaviour? Oh, atrocious. Anybody else would have been kicked out. He was a sergeant until the Canadian High Commissioner. You see, he was a great hero in the Canadian press because he was an ace, shot down the airplane. And I said, why is he a sergeant? He should be a wing commander or a group captain or something. But he couldn't speak or write, you know, there's no way he could make it. But eventually they had to give him a commission on the Canadian High Commissioner and said, look, we've got to give this chap a commission. So he was commissioned, and he never wore his badges of rank. He never knew what he didn't bother putting them on, or his decorations.
You told me off the tape as well about the occasion when he had an encounter with a senior officer.
Yes, I can't think of his name now. He's an Olympic hurdler, a station commander who was an absolute beast of a man. He was a tremendous disciplinarian. I don't think he flew in the war. I think he was a bit too old for it. But he was a great disciplinarian. Over the top disciplinary, you know. But he and Burling were two ends of the pole. One was a total disciplinarian. Burling just didn't understand what discipline meant. And so they were constantly loggerheads. And I think I told you about the incident when he came down to lunchtime in the mess one day. We're all sitting down, including Burling. It was at the end of the table, near the centre where the there's a sort of centre aisle going between the tables, leading to a top table which was slightly raised where the station commander used to sit always with his cronies around him. And Burning was sitting right at the edge near the aisle. And he used to eat with his hands, knife and forks and meat, so he'd meet out with his hair hanging all over the place. And it just arrived at the unit Burning had. As the station commander was walking past him with his retinue to absolutely spit and polished up the eyebrows. He saw Burling, he saw this apparition sitting there. But it could have been the ACH, it could have been an airman. He didn't want to rank or anything. But he knew him. And he said, Burling, get your hair cut, in a voice which we could all hear. He stopped and said, Burling, you've got to get your hair cut. And then walked on, and Burning said, fuck off, in a voice equally as loud. And I totally thought, oh dear, what's that? But you see, he wasn't near, the station commander was in a funny position, because if he disciplined him, the High Commissioner, the Canadian High Commissioner, would be onto him and say, hey, why is this chap flying? What's wrong? What's wrong? Well, he's a bit wild, but he's a good fighter pilot, you know. But his idea of a day off was to take a 12 ball and lots of cartridges, climb up a tree off the edge of the airfield somewhere, grab a pack of sandwiches, go up at dawn, and anything that moved within shot, he'd shoot, and he'd get it, kill it. No matter if it was flying past, on the ground, whatever it was, bang. And so finished the day littered with rabbits and crows and pigeons all about him. It was a tremendous shot. I mean, clay pigeon shooting, if he'd gone into the Olympics, he'd have been world champion. He could hit a clay pigeon from any angle.
What was he like as a pilot, as opposed to, you know, you mentioned he's good at gunnery, but was he a good pilot?
Well, I never actually flew with him, a Spitfire alongside him. But he must have been extremely good, yeah. I mean, he did a lot of good in Malta. He shot a lot of aircraft down in Malta. And also, he had this extraordinary, he knew exactly where his shells were going. You know, when you hit an enemy aircraft, you can see, have an idea, because you can see lots of smoke. But he'd say, well, I guess I put three cannon shells just behind the leading edge and two more went into the side. You actually know where the number of shells that hit the aircraft in a matter of seconds. You only had about less than 10 seconds. 7 seconds or five or seven seconds fire of all your ammunition. And you carried a wing sack full of it because it went out at such a rate. So you couldn't just sort of sit behind something and keep your finger on the button. You fired in short bursts. And that was it.
I take it with somebody like him, it's a real rarity that you've come across people who have.
Well, I think of all the fighter pilots in the RAF, he was an odd one, a total oddball. Had no fear of anything or of anybody, no fear of authority, total disdain for authority, in fact. But he knew that he was good, and didn't drink, didn't smoke, never went out with a girl. Total oddball.
Because you mentioned, obviously, people like Al Dear and Paddy Finnegan being leaders. Did he lack that leadership quality? I mean, obviously,
he could never have made a squadron commander, never. He wouldn't know how to handle the fellows, you know, he wouldn't know how to talk to them. I don't think he ever made flight commander, in fact. Flight commander, I don't think he made even that. He didn't. He had no leadership qualities. And he didn't talk to anybody.
Did he operate on his own?
Absolutely. Well, he operated with a squadron, but as soon as any enemy aircraft were about, he was away. He's got to nail one man fast. He seemed to have no nerves like the average chap had. Nothing seemed to get him down at all. If he hadn't joined the RAF, he'd have still been chopping trees down in northern Canada.
Did you even understand what his motivation was? What really moved him? Was it just to be a fighter pilot, do you think? Was that what he wanted to do?
I think so. He probably, as a young lad, read about it. Thought, well, I'd like to do that. And just joined. I don't think there's a sense of patriotism as far as he was concerned. After all, he was a Canadian, he was all right.
And do you know what his attitude towards the enemy was at all?
Well, he was just going to kill him. He didn't worry him at all. There's not much chivalry about Burling. We'd had a whole fighter command full of Burlings with very few enemy aircraft about.
I'll hold you on